go ahead.
I still have to wet the whistle a little. Good morning, everyone. My name is Jim Doney, and I'm an alcoholic. It's wonderful to be here. It's a wonderful day to be sober. It's wonderful to look out over this crowd of sober people, too. And I want to thank the committee for a wonderful evening last night, a great dinner, and a lot of good camaraderie and fellowship. Had a great time. And I've had a great time this morning chatting with a lot of you. I appreciate the introduction, Mark, not because it was so personal, but because it seemed to go well. Not all introductions have gone that well for me. I was on a lecture circuit for a while, a national lecture circuit, and one night I was appearing at a place where the chairman said, I have an announcement to make. Next month, our meeting will be held in the high school auditorium rather than this little church chapel because we have a really good speaker and we're expecting a much larger crowd. Another night, another announcement. Don't forget, folks, it's bingo night. And when our speaker gets done, the fun will begin. They even got me in the treasurer's report once. He wasn't even introducing me. He was given the treasurer's report, and he said, I hate to break this news to you, but the dues are going up so we can get some decent speakers in here next season. I always hope they didn't really mean it, but maybe they did. I don't know. It may give you some idea what to expect this morning. On the personal side, I always like to know where the guy's from and what he's been doing. It has nothing to do with my drinking. But I was born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio. In 1975, I moved to Hawaii. I lived there for 25 years. I moved to Georgia 6 years ago. I wasn't sure I was going to like it after leaving Hawaii, but I love it. And the people have been so wonderful to me here. I was only in Georgia once before in my life. I came down and spoke at a conference over on Jekyll Island around 1974, and I had something of a spiritual experience in an old church over there. I remembered that, and from that I had a warm spot in my heart for Georgia. And when I got here, I joined the Depot group up in Kennesaw, made some instant friends, and discovered that Georgia had a warm spot in its heart for me. And I really appreciate it. I looked at the advanced publicity for this morning. Advanced publicity always scares me because publicity people always promise more than the talent can deliver. It's always stupendous and tremendous and all of that, and you're not, you know. But anyway, the first thing I noticed was they mentioned that I'd been sober at now over 46 years, and it occurred to me that there may be some new people, and there are, of course, in the room, who think that because I've been sober for some time, I may know something that the rest of you don't know, or have some tool or secret that the rest of you don't know. Well, I've got news for you. I don't. I don't know any secrets. I don't know any more than you do. I don't have any tools you don't have. I stay sober the same way I always did and that you always do. I don't drink one day at a time. I go to meetings. I still have sponsors in my heart. Most of them have passed on. I had a couple of different sponsors. But I can be sponsored by a new person coming in the program because they give me strength and hope that the program is growing and that new people are joining us all the time. And Mary can be my sponsor now because I can watch her grow now in the program and others that are new to our program. They're my sponsors. I lived in Hawaii. I now live in Georgia. I made my living in the television business. When I had hair, I was a performer. When I started to lose my hair, I became a character actor. And when I completely lost it, they made me an executive. So that's the way it goes in the TV business. I don't know anything that you don't know. I just go to meetings and read some literature. And try to practice these principles in all of my affairs, and I try to contact my higher power every day and listen for answers. That's something I've learned, is to listen and pay attention to the answer when they come. Now, the other part of the publicity that scared me a little is the part about knowing Sister Ignatia. And I did, of course, but if you're expecting a detailed, intimate account of my knowledge of Sister Ignatia's persona and personality, let me explain to you what you're asking. You're asking an 80-year-old man to recall things that happened more than 40 years ago when he was coming off a 3-year drunk. Not likely. I'll give you a sample of what kind of condition I was in. A month or two before I came on the program, I was drinking in a cocktail lounge, and there was a young blonde girl, rather attractive, sitting a few stools away from me in the bar, and she smiled in my direction, and I thought she even gave a little wave. Now, I was aware that there were some young ladies whose hobby it was to make the acquaintance of celebrities. Usually those celebrities were athletes or musicians, but every once in a while there'd be someone of discerning taste who would want to get acquainted with a television news anchor, which is what I was doing at the time. And so when she smiled and waved, I was not one to discourage her efforts to acquaint. And in fact, I felt it was almost my duty as a public figure to cooperate. So I moved down the bar and sat next to her and struck up a conversation, which I thought was going very well, when she suddenly inquired about the health of my parents. And I said, well, my mom and dad are okay, I guess. Why do you ask? And she said, Jim, I'm your cousin. I then had to ad-lib like crazy in a hurry to try and convince her that I knew that all along. I was just kidding you. My wife used to berate me for forgetting the names of close relatives a lot, but that's the first time I ever forgot the face of a close relative. But that's the state my mind was in a few months before I came into AA and before I met Sister Ignatia. It was pretty boggled. The first few days I was in Rosary Hall, I thought I was on a boat. I kept asking people how long they'd been aboard, which way is the galley, all kinds of nautical talk. I don't know where I got any nautical talk. I'd never been on a boat in my life. Well, once I took a day trip on a ferry in Lake Erie called the Aquarama, went up to Detroit and back all in one day, and there was a bar on the Aquarama. I didn't do any sightseeing in Detroit or Lake Erie. I drank in the bar. That was the only thing I can remember about that day is that I almost ran over my mother-in-law trying to get my car off the ferry. But that's another story completely. But I didn't pick up any nautical language on that occasion, that's for sure. The next phase I went through in Rosary Hall, I was an undercover reporter, and I was going to do an expose on these crooked Catholic nuns and the racket that they had running up here. I was not Catholic, and I didn't trust them. And you've heard stories about, you know, guys that check themselves into insane asylums or jails or whatever so they can write an expose on how they were really treated. I really convinced myself that that's what I was doing. And then it suddenly occurred to me that I'd been laid off from my job. I wasn't a news announcer anymore. And there was no place to file my report. But I felt it was my civic duty to report them to some authority. I certainly didn't want to call the police. I tried to not involve the police in my life as much as possible in those days. So I went to an even higher authority. I tried to get a line out of Rosary Hall so that I could report Sister Ignatia and the crooked nuns to the Better Business Bureau. And I was sure that we were all being held hostage there, that they were bilking us out of our life savings. My worldly wealth at the moment consisted of a 6-year-old banged-up Chevrolet with a case of empty whiskey bottles in the trunk. Two items well known to be highly prized by Catholic nuns. God, my mind must have really been fried. I had my last drink in Rosary Hall on September 4th, 1960. It was old overholt and old overcoat, I guess, or something, and formaldehyde. And the next day, I knew it was my last drink, so I decided I was going to leave. And I tried to escape. There was no escape from Rosary Hall. Those pajamas were pretty obvious, with RHS written all over them. Anybody that saw you in the hall knew where you belonged and took you back. And if I had gotten out, where would I have gone? You know, I didn't have a car or anything in those pajamas. I realized I couldn't escape. So I went to the office and called on my legal knowledge, which was nil, but I threatened to sue them because I was being held against my will. And I went through a long tirade, and strangely enough, they told me I could go. They told me I could have my clothes and I could go home. But Sister Ignatia had to sign my release, and they couldn't find her. She was somehow missing from Rosary Hall that day. They couldn't locate her, but as soon as she came back, she'd sign my release, and I said, okay. That night, I went into the DTs. I was in no danger, but I watched a show out the window of the hospital in a parking lot across the street in which there were knives and guns and chains being wielded. People were dying. They were bleeding in the street, and they were all singing. I can still remember some of the songs they did. It was sort of a West Side Story rumble. That was a popular show at the time. Maybe that's where I got the idea. I don't know. None of the other guys in the ward were interested in it somehow. They were trying to sleep, and I'd had some experience doing sports, so I did a play-by-play, blow-by-blow description for a while. And there was one guy from Youngstown who told me later that he knew I was in DTs, but it sounded so good he got up and looked anyway. He thought, maybe the guy's really got something here, you know, and he'd get up. It was an empty parking lot. And they gave me some orange juice with something in it, knocked me out. And I slept most of the next day. When I woke up, the night nurse was on duty, and she kidded me about the show out the window, asked me if I was going to put it on TV, and stuff like that. And I said to her, you mean it didn't really happen? And she said, what do you think, Jim? And walked out of the room. And I started to think about what I had seen. Nobody had asked me what I thought for a long time. A lot of people had been telling me what they thought of me, but nobody had asked me what I thought of me. And I sat on the bed, and I think I took an inventory that day, without even knowing it was one of our steps. But my mind had cleared up enough that I was able to see myself for who I was and what I was, what kind of a father I was, what kind of a husband, what kind of a worker, what kind of a son, what kind of a man I had become. And I didn't like it. I admitted that day I was an alcoholic. And I started to read the literature and tried to understand it. I had a lot of trouble understanding it, but I tried. And Sister Ignatia somehow miraculously appeared. She showed up that day. And I talked to her, and I told her that I'd tried to find her the day before so she could sign my release. And she said, I know, I was here all the time. And I said, how could you have been here? I looked in every room. And she said, I was in the chapel praying for you. And I knew with your attitude about God and religion, that's the last place you'd look. And she was right. Never occurred to me to look for a nun in a chapel. Oh, boy. I don't know a lot about Sister Ignatia, except that she had an attitude about her that was calm and serene. She smiled constantly. She never accused anybody of anything. She never called them any names. She never mentioned alcoholism or alcoholic. She told you were sick, you were in the hospital for treatment, and you were in good hands. Relax and enjoy it. There were all kinds of stories about Sister Ignatia that I heard circulated from time to time, about how she cussed out some truck driver and put him in his place, and another one about how she actually knocked somebody off their feet into a chair and then preached to him. I think these stories, I don't believe them. I think they were exaggerated versions of something. There were a lot of tough guys that went through Rosary Hall, and I think they thought that those stories would enhance her reputation in some way. They meant it as a compliment, really, to her. But it not only wasn't true, because I don't think that she heard a lot of obscene words in her role, I'm sure, from obstreperous guys as they came through. But I don't think there were any of those words in her vocabulary. And she couldn't possibly have knocked anybody off their feet. She was barely 5 feet tall herself and weighed about 90 pounds. Plus the fact that she didn't have to. Her manner was such that she calmed you, settled you down. She shared her serenity with you immediately. And it worked. I later on, as I went back as a visitor and sponsoring people, I saw her at work with new people. And it was that calming effect that was the most notable part of her personality. She could settle them down in a hurry. She had a great sense of humor. One of the nuns came to her one day and said that one of the patients was talking about converting to Catholicism. Sister Ignatius said, "What is he now?" And she said, "I think he's a Presbyterian." Sister Ignatius said, "Let's make him a good Presbyterian first." First things first. She practiced the principles of AA too. First things first. On another occasion, a guy was trying to impress her, I guess, and he said, "I'm not Catholic, but I'm high Episcopalian. I understand that's the next best thing." And she smiled at him and said, "A miss is as good as a mile." So she could be pretty funny. When I left Rosary Hall, she gave me three things. She gave me a book called Confidence in God, a Sacred Heart medallion, and a little card that she wrote a message in. I still have the Confidence in God pamphlet. The Sacred Heart and the card have been misplaced somehow in my many moves since then. But I still have the book. And the little pamphlet starts out with a chapter about watch the present. It says, don't cry over spilled milk. You've made mistakes. You've done some wrong things. Atone for them. Make amends. Get over it and move on. That's what where the book starts. It's a Catholic document, but it has an awful lot of good AA stuff in it. It concludes with a chapter about confidence in God, which is the name of the pamphlet. And that chapter is called A Full Heart. And it's well named because with confidence in a higher power, you can and do have a full heart. Somewhere in the middle of that, there's a chapter about ministering, about the work that you do. And they say anybody can be a minister. Anybody, it's just working good for other people. And it's done even better if it's done in obscurity. And I know that Sister Ignatia practiced that because she never asked for anything. Never asked for recognition. Never asked for reward. Never asked for anything. She didn't ask for award at St. Thomas Hospital in Akron. They observed what she was doing, were impressed by the example she set, and they offered her an award. They called her into a meeting with an architect and said, "What do you need?" She hadn't asked for anything. She said, "I need 3 days to think about it." But she did, and built the ward that's, I believe, now named for her at St. Thomas in Akron. Later on, someone said, "We need a ward in Cleveland at St. Vincent Charity Hospital. Will you head it up?" She did, and built that one, along with Sister Victorine. And again, it was the example that she set. She never asked for those. She never asked for anything. She just wanted to help other people who were in trouble, and particularly alcoholics, because she was so impressed with Dr. Bob and Bill. Rosary Hall, the official name of Rosary Hall is Rosary Hall Solarium, RHS, which happened to be Dr. Bob's initials, and that's why she named it that way, so that those initials would appear. The best description I can give, I should have mentioned the little card that she wrote the message in. When I got it home, I opened it, and I thought I knew what it would say. You know, "I'll be praying for you," or something like that. Mm-hmm. When I opened it and read it, it said, "Pray for me." I lived in Hawaii for 25 years. Hawaii has a great senator, Dan Inouye. You'll hear him called Inouye by the network news guys. They mispronounce it, and he's too polite to correct them. It's pronounced in no way. But anyway, I heard him speak at a meeting, at a dinner, in which they were giving away public service awards in Honolulu. And he told a story that really impressed me. He said that some people, some politicians, referred to themselves as being in public service. He said, they're not, and I'm not. He said, I'm not a public servant. I'm a government employee. He said, I am in government service. To him, a person who was in public service was one of the people who were being honored with the awards that day. And as an example, he spoke, excuse me a second. He spoke of a millionaire friend of his who had to wait some period of time in a waiting room in a hospital. And as he sat there watching, a nun who was working as a nurse's aide went back and forth with a mop and a broom and a dustpan and a bucket and then a bedpan that had obviously been used in and out of a closet. And he could hear the water running as she washed those things out and went back. And came back the last time she went through, it was with a clear plastic bag she was holding almost at arm's length, carrying what looked like bloody bandages, and into the closet she went again. And he could hear the water running for a long time. And she came out drying her hands with a paper towel. And he stopped her. And he said, "Sister, I've been watching you. And I wouldn't do what you do for $1 million." And she looked him in the eye and said, "Neither would I." To Senator Inouye, that was public service. To me, that was Sister Ignatia. Never ask for a thing, but she'd do anything for you. Anything within her power. When I left Rosary Hall, there was a sign over the door that said, "Take hope, all ye who leave here." I thought that's all I had, but I didn't. I had other things. I had a sponsor, and I had the goodwill of a lot of other people that I didn't even know about. One of the first places I went, one of the first meetings I went to, became my home group in Independence, Ohio, which is about halfway between Akron and Cleveland. That's where my sponsor went. And so he took me there, and there was a man who ran that meeting. He was sort of the honorary permanent chairman, who dated back to 1938 or 1939 in the program. He helped to write the traditions. He was on the committee that wrote the traditions that were introduced at the first international convention in 1950 in Cleveland. Howard B. was his name, and he became my mentor, not my sponsor, but my mentor. My sponsor was a lawyer that I had been drunk with on a few occasions that I didn't know very well. He had gotten sober, and we had a mutual friend who had asked him to talk to me, and that's how I got connected with him. I couldn't understand him. After I got out of Rosary Hall, I had a very difficult time knowing what he was trying to tell me. And I met another guy named Ken W., that I hit it off with very well, and I could understand him, and our wives liked each other. We had kids about the same age. Everything seemed to work out, and I wanted to switch sponsorship, but I didn't know whether that was appropriate or not, and I didn't want to hurt Ellis's feelings. And so I went to Howard B. as my mentor and asked him what I should do about that situation. And Howard said, "Well, the first thing you should do is ask Ken if he wants to be your sponsor. And if he says yes, then go to Ellis and, as a last resort, tell him the truth." He said, "Just level with him. Just tell him. You've met a guy, you hit it off well, you like him and understand him. He's willing to be your sponsor and you'd like to switch." And Ellis, being a gentleman, will say, "That's perfectly fine, Jim, go right ahead." That's what he'll say to you because he's polite, but he may be thinking, "Oh, thank God I'm rid of this nut at last." Howard dealt with you straight from the shoulder. He did not mess around. And I liked him, as I needed that. And I switched sponsors. So that's why I have two sponsors and one mentor along the way. Howard threw an old-timers night the first month or so that I was in the program. There were 10 guys up on the stage, all of whom claimed 20 years or more of sobriety. And that was 1960. So they all went back to that late 1930s period. And I didn't believe any of them. I thought they were all lying, of course. I wish I knew now who they all were. Howard's the only one I can remember by name. They all spoke for maybe 5 or 6 minutes. That's all the time they had because there were 10 guys. And they spoke for an hour, so they each had about 6 minutes. But each one of them told some kind of a story. Three of the stories have stuck with me all these years, even though it was a very early meeting. One of the guys told a story about a kid that worked on a farm, did chores, went to school, helped his family. Very poor family, he never had any fun. And one day they put a big placard up on the barn about a circus coming to town. He didn't know what a circus was, but his father thought he needed a treat, so he gave him 50 cents and sent him into town on the Saturday that the circus was to arrive. And when he got into town, the circus parade was coming up the street. And he watched it and saw the band go by and the clowns in their funny costumes and beautiful ladies in elegant costumes, and he saw the animals in the cages and the elephants marching, and a clown came by and tipped his hat, and he put his 50 cents in there because he thought that's how he paid for the admission. And the clown put his hat on and the parade went around the corner, and the boy walked back to the farm to tell the family he had been to the circus. And he hadn't. He had only seen the parade. He'd never gotten in the big tent, never actually saw the show and didn't know the difference. His point was that he saw some people approach AA that way. They came to a few meetings and they saw the parade and they listened to a little bit, but they never really got in it. They never really got under the big top. They never saw the big show. They never got in it with both feet, both hands, heart and brain, and really got in it and saw what was really going on. That was his point. He said, don't be like that if you're a newcomer. And I decided, okay, that's good advice. I'm going to get in it with both feet. The next guy told a story that I've heard many times since. It's a common story. It goes around. The last time I heard it was during the flooding in New Orleans. It came around on the internet, but it's the same old story. And it was a guy who heard on the radio an alert about possible flooding. And he said, well, I'm praying God will save me. And he turned on the TV later in the day, and this time it was a flood warning. The flood was coming. And he said, that's all right. God will take care of me. I'm saying my prayers. The next thing he knew, the water was coming in the front door. And a guy pulled up in a rowboat and said, get in, I'll get you out of there. He said, no, I'll wait. I'm praying God will save me. And next thing he knew, the water was coming in the second floor, and he was on the roof. And a guy came by in a helicopter and shouted with a bullhorn, grab the ladder, I'll get you out of there. He said, no, I'm praying to God. God will save me. And the helicopter went away, and a wave washed over the house, and he drowned. And the next thing he knew, he was standing at the pearly gates talking to St. Peter. And St. Peter said, what the hell are you doing here? And he said, that's what I'm wondering. I've been praying all day, asking God to help, and it didn't help. And St. Peter said, he sent you a message on the radio. He sent you a message on the television. He sent you a rowboat. He sent you a helicopter. You just weren't listening. You weren't paying attention. I remembered that, too. And I started to look for the answers to my prayers. And believe it or not, I could see them. They came. They started to come, and they've never stopped. They keep coming. The last story that I can remember was about a young athlete from the South who won an athletic scholarship. He was a great track star. And he won an athletic scholarship to Notre Dame and went up there. His father was a Baptist minister. When he came home for the holidays, they were all seated around a holiday dinner table. And the father said grace, which was their custom. And the boy crossed himself. And the father noticed that gesture because it was not the custom in a Baptist home. He said, where'd you learn to do that? And he said, Notre Dame. He said, when do you do that? He said, before I eat, before I go to bed, and before I race. And his father said, why do you do that? He said, I don't know, but I'm eating good, I'm sleeping good, and I'm winning. His point was, you have a few simple suggested steps in this program. If you follow them, whether you understand them or not, just do it, and you'll be eating good and sleeping good and winning one day at a time. I've remembered that one for a long time, too. Everything Howard ever told me came true. He told me a lot about myself. He was an interesting man. We were talking about the fact that I at one time denied I was an alcoholic at all, And then I thought I was the worst one that ever lived. Then when I got into AA and heard other people's stories, I discovered I was a mediocre garden variety average drunk, you know. And I was decrying that fact because I told Howard, I never wanted to be mediocre at anything. I always wanted to excel. I didn't want to be mediocre. Howard said, did it ever occur to you, Jim, that for you, mediocrity is a step up? He asked me to give my first talk, or we used to call them leads, and he asked me to lead a group called the Angle Group. The Angle Group met in a church on the west end of the high-level bridge over the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland. Most of the guys in that group had lived under that bridge for some time before they got in that group. This is what you might call a low-bottom group. They were tough guys, and he asked me to speak to them. And I was a, you know, cocktail lounge drinker, a TV celebrity. I was a star, all of that. I didn't think I had anything to share with those guys. And I told him, I don't think I have anything that will do them any good. He said, I don't think you do either. He said, I want you to talk because it'll do you some good. He said, I know you well enough to know that you'll sit down and do an inventory, and you'll have to prepare some material, and you'll have to think about yourself, and maybe for the first time you'll start getting honest with yourself. In preparation for that talk, he said, I'm hoping it'll help you. And he was right. I did. I'd been sober almost a year, but I still hadn't been totally honest with myself yet. But I started. Everything he said came true. One night he was with me, and I was on my way down to Akron to speak to a group. I was the speaker of the night. It was a rainy night, snowy, really sleet, and a lot of traffic, and we were late. And I kept getting more and more agitated and nervous and upset. And he finally said, what are you getting so worked up about? And I said, Howard, I'm the speaker. And we're, you know, this meeting starts in 10 minutes. And we're nowhere near the place. And we're not moving. And I'm upset. And he said, wait a minute. You're not the speaker. You're a speaker. You think they don't have another speaker at that meeting? You think they don't have somebody there that will tell their story? You think they won't have a good meeting without you? He said, they know it's snowing. They know why you're going to be late. If we're going to be late, they'll forgive you. If you don't get there at all, they'll have a perfectly good meeting and I'll go home sober and happy anyway. You are not indispensable, Jim. Everything Howard told me came true. We made that meeting on time and everything was okay. I never missed a date like that until about 2 years ago, when I was supposed to speak at an ice cream social in East Cobb County, and I had detailed instructions given to me by a member of that group who must have been an alcoholic because the directions were completely erroneous. And I never made it to that meeting. I rode up and down Paper Mill Road 8 or 10 times and never found the driveway, and finally just gave up and went home. But do you think they didn't have a meeting that night? Helen Rowe was there that night, and she spoke in my place. And I didn't get a chance to thank her until this morning. Thank you, Helen. Everything Howard told me came true. I stood at Howard's funeral. There were a lot of people there. And somebody made the remark, that guy in there in the casket will never be replaced in this program. And another old-timer said, don't you say that. And he hit me in the chest with the back of his hand. And he said, this guy will replace him. He said, every guy Howard ever talked to, ever helped, there are hundreds of them out there that will replace him. They'll take his place and they'll pass the word on and it will keep on going. And I stood there and thought to myself, wow, what a responsibility he just dumped on me. I'm going to replace Howard? Thank goodness there are hundreds of us that I can share that responsibility with. But knowing that, think of the thrill I got, the high, the feeling, the glory that I felt when I heard from Mark. a year ago asking me to speak at this meeting this morning and telling me that he had a tape that I had done in 1966 and that he had listened to it over and over and helped him get sober. Here's a guy that I've never seen in my life. Two different cities, two different ways of life probably, except in one way we were the same. He gives me credit for helping him with his sobriety. I give him credit for helping reinforce my confidence in a higher power that made me an instrument of his sobriety. And we never met face to face until last night. Is this a miraculous program or what? That kind of stuff has been happening to me all along. The first incidents I can remember, I got back to work, and my boss had been a former newspaper man, and he threw a party every year, tried to get newspaper and radio and TV people together. There's no love lost between those two businesses. And he wanted us to get together at a big luncheon. It was in a very fancy restaurant. He always served sparkling burgundy. He liked sparkling burgundy. It always came in beautiful stemmed glasses. And it was used for a round of toasts, which between the radio and TV guys and the newspaper guys became roasts because they really threw harpoons at each other. They didn't like each other much. And his toasts usually ended up being pretty insulting. And that party was coming up. I got sober in September, and this was just before Christmas that he threw the party, and I tried to duck it, but he wanted me to be there, and I was still trying to make amends to him, and so I went. And I talked to my sponsor before I went about it, because I knew I wasn't going to drink, but what I was afraid of was that I was going to end up with a glass of red wine in front of me, blinking on and off like a red neon sign, pointing at the guy with the problem. You know, everybody else would drink, and mine would still be there. I thought it would be embarrassing to not drink at that party. I did not yet know that I have never been embarrassed in my life by not drinking. Nobody's ever said, "Oh, man, get a load of Donnie. Is he sober tonight?" You know, nobody ever said that. Anyway, the waiters came down the line at that party. There were two of them, and I told you they were real pros. One of them had a polishing cloth, and all he did was turn the glass right side up and polish it out with a little swish. The guy with the bottle filled it right to the brim. By that time, the guy had swished the next glass. He was over there filling that one. They came down the line, up swish pour, up swish pour, up swish pour. They were magnificent. Got to me, and the guy flipped my glass up, swished it out, turned it back upside down, and the bottle went by me so fast I couldn't even smell the sparkling burgundy. I never got a glass of wine. I toasted in my water glass. The guys were very kind to me. They kidded me about a newscast I had done, but nothing personal and nothing about drinking. It was a very easy afternoon. It was a fun party. I was sober the whole way. I heard all the good jokes and remembered them. And I saw the waiter later, and I said, "Did my boss tell you to do that?" He said, "Hell no, I saw you at a meeting Tuesday night." Going back to my sponsor, he said, "How'd it go?" I said, "How'd it go? What a coincidence. I drew an AA waiter, and he went right down my throat. What do you mean, coincidence?" He said, "Well, did you say your prayer?" I said, "Yes." He said, "What do you say when you pray?" I said, "Well, I usually say I'm Jim Doney. I'm an alcoholic. I would like to stay sober today. I'll do my best, but help me if I get lost. Help me if I get in trouble, or show me the way if I get lost." He said, "Okay, you asked for help and you got help. What the hell is so coincidental about that?" You ask him to help you, he did. Go home and thank him tonight. And I did. And it's been happening to me ever since. It comes in strange ways sometimes. I started to do a new show. It was a travel program. It was the best thing I ever did on television. It allowed me to travel all over the world, go to meetings in foreign countries. I was off shooting travel logs in some strange and fascinating places. And I was in Hong Kong making a film, and I had a Chinese guide, a young man, 21, 22 years old. He was with me for several days and showed me around Hong Kong. Very nice young man. And we had meals together, of course. And he noticed that whenever he ordered a beer, I ordered a Coke. And he finally said, he was a little surprised to find an American who didn't drink. And he said to me, don't you drink? And I said, no. And he said, did you ever drink? And I said, yes. I used to drink a lot. That's why I don't drink at all anymore. And he said, oh, you must be an AA. And I said, yes, I am. How do you know about AA? Now, I had looked up AA in the International Directory before I went. There were only 10 AAs in Hong Kong at that time. And out of a city of, I think, 4 or 5 million people, there were only 10 AAs. They were in two groups, one on the island, on Hong Kong Island, and the other one in the city of Victoria. And there were four members each. There were still two independents who wouldn't align with either group. Free thinkers, I guess. But anyway, I said, how did you know about AA? And he said, they taught us about AA at Hong Kong University. He said, our class in social problems taught us about AA and what a wonderful organization it is. He said, you know, I wish my father had been from a city where they had AA. And he told me that his father was a silk salesman from Shantung Province. And he traveled all over the Orient and fell into the trap that so many traveling salesmen do and became an alcoholic, and it killed him. And he knew that it was alcohol that killed his father. And he knew there was something called AA that might have helped if it had been available. And he sat there and said to me, how happy you must be, how grateful you must be to be from a city where there's AA. And you know that earlier that morning, I wasn't ready to take a drink. But I was thinking, who would know if I did? I'm halfway around the world. My wife wouldn't know. My sponsor wouldn't know. Those thoughts were going through my mind until lunch, until that kid talked to me and said those words about gratitude and how happy I must be to be from a city where there was AA. And I later figured out, I didn't realize it at the time, but I said my prayer that morning too. And that day the message came through a 21-year-old Chinese boy who'd never been to an AA meeting in his life. But he had the words that I needed that day. I really count on that happening. One of the first meetings I went to was a morning meeting. And when I got my job back, I was working nights for a while, so I had to go to daytime meetings. And I walked into this meeting on the east side of Cleveland. I didn't know anybody over there. But a big black guy came running across the room and threw his arms around me and hugged me. And he said, you're Mr. Doney, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And he said, oh, I'm so glad to see you. I've been praying for you. And I said, oh, that's great. I appreciate it. But why? I said, I never saw you before in my life. He said, my son works in the garage where you park your car. And he used to come home and tell me, oh, Mr. Doney had a load on tonight. We hated to give him his car keys tonight. And I could remember, they used to hold me up and give me coffee and pretend they couldn't find my car and all kinds of stuff to delay me and try and get me into shape to drive. Those young men really looked out for me in that garage. And this one went home and told his dad, who was an AA, Mr. Doney was in bad shape tonight. And he said, I would pray that you'd get home safe, and then I'd pray that you'd come to us. And he said, my prayers have been answered. Now, my wife thought her prayers were answered, and my mother thought her prayers were answered. You know, that man was sure his prayers were answered. And I don't know whose prayers were answered, but boy, I'm glad it was the right answer. Not too long ago, I was on another kind of speaking tour on a lecture circuit, and I ended up in Roswell, New Mexico on a night, an off night. I didn't have a speech that night, but I had one the next night at the Roswell Inn. So I thought I'd try a meeting, and I looked in the phone book, and I couldn't find AA. So I didn't do anything. I just watched TV or something. It wasn't, you know, urgent that I go to a meeting. It was just something to do. But the next day, my phone rang in the hotel room, and it was a guy from Cleveland who was retired to Roswell. He'd been a school teacher. And he knew me not only from TV in Cleveland, but he knew me from AA. We'd been to meetings together. And he invited me to come to his home group that night. And I said, I can't do it because I'm speaking at 7 o'clock. And their meeting was at 7 o'clock. And he said, these are all farm people. They meet early and they go home early and go to bed because they get up early. But he said, if you don't mind, he said, my wife and I can pick you up after your talk. We can go over to the club and just have some coffee, and there'll be a few people around. We can talk. And I said, that's great. I'd love to. So they picked me up after my speech at the Roswell Inn and took me to their clubhouse in Roswell. And when I walked in, there were probably 50 people sitting there waiting. And as I walked in, the chairman said, okay, we can start. They had held the 7 o'clock meeting. He had told them there was a guy in town looking for a meeting last night and couldn't find one. So they all decided to stay and hold another meeting at 9 o'clock for me. I tried to thank them, and some old cowboy in the front row said, oh, hell, we didn't want you going back to Hawaii telling people you couldn't find a meeting in Roswell. I don't know where in the world I could run into any other group that would do that for you. I don't know where in the world I would run into an organization of people where at one time I had picked out guys I decided I didn't like. I was willing to love them like a brother, but I didn't necessarily want to sit next to them at meetings. I had a few of those. And a couple of them turned out to be guys. They went from guys I didn't like to guys I wanted to be like. They set examples for me. They said, oh, my, whatever it is those guys have got, I want some of that. I want what they did. One of them was a man whose son was killed by a drunken driver on Christmas Eve. And he stayed sober and expressed gratitude that he had at least been a good father to the boy for the last 10 years, a lot longer than I'd given him credit for sobriety. He was one of those that had an accent and wore dirty clothes, and I didn't want to sit next to him at a meeting. But when I saw him at the funeral, he was well-dressed and he was in control. He was in grief, but he was also able to express gratitude. He had also lost a son in the Korean War that had never known him as a sober father. But he was grateful that this boy had known a sober father for 10 years. I thought, I want to be like Mike. Whatever it is he's got that has enabled him to handle this like this, I want to be like that. I've made some trades in my life. If I were a general manager of a baseball team, I'd be world famous because I've really made good trades. I'm not kidding. I traded pity and contempt for self-respect and serenity. I lived in an atmosphere of pity and contempt. People that knew what was wrong with me pitied me. People that didn't understand what was wrong with me had nothing but contempt for me. Or so I thought. But I traded that in for some self-respect and for serenity. I traded humiliation, embarrassment, and degradation for experience, strength, and hope. I got all of those in AA, of course. I traded greed for more, for gratitude for what I had. Best trade I ever made, I traded a moment of pleasure for a life of happiness. What a difference. What a good trade that was. And now the funny thing is that even that moment of pleasure was phony. I never really found in the bottle what I was looking for. But I have found it in AA. The companionship, the social aspect, the friends, the good times, the laughs. Sometimes the laughs came in strange ways, but they're there, and the good times are there. I remember one of my first meetings, they handed me a broom, and I knew they didn't expect me to fly at home, so I was sweeping the floor, and I looked over, and my wife was talking to Howard and his wife, and they were laughing at me. And I didn't think it was very funny. So I swept over in their direction, and when I got close enough for them to hear me, I said, what the hell's so funny? And my wife said, I was just telling Howard and his wife that it was only a month ago I told you if you didn't quit drinking, you'd end up sweeping floors. And she had. That's it. And I remembered that, and I laughed about it too. All of a sudden, I wasn't mad anymore. They weren't laughing at me. They were laughing with me. There were things that I swore I'd never tell another human being that I ended up sharing with my sponsor and others, and we laughed about them. I wasn't the worst one that ever lived. I wasn't the best one, just a mediocre, average, garden variety drunk. I stumbled over a couple of words along the way. Insanity was one of them. I did not like our step about restoring us to sanity, because to take that step implied that I was insane, and I didn't want to admit I was insane. I think back about the boat and the underground reporter and all of that. Now it's easy to see that I was nuts, but it wasn't easy then. It took a while to get over that. The other word that bothered me for a while was humility, believe it or not. I confused it with humiliation. And I thought, I hope I'm through with the humiliation. Why would I want to establish more humiliation? Of course, they're two different words. They sound something alike, but they're not at all alike. And that had to be explained to me in careful detail. Howard, again, was the guy who did it best. He said, Jim, humility is nothing but honesty. It's another word for honesty. It's an honest assessment of yourself. Your assets, you've got some. And your faults, you've got them too. It's just an honest assessment of what they are without exaggerating either one. It's honesty. I've done a little research on the word. And Howard, I think it was, that mentioned, or Ken, I'm not sure which, but even Shakespeare knew about it. He wrote, "To thine own self be true." Self-honesty. And other authors and writers, T.S. Eliot and many others, have written about humility. They all have slightly different ideas, but all there's a thread of continuity in all of them. But the best one I read is from a man named Ralph W. Sockman, and I have no idea who he is. But this quote appeared in a magazine called The Arkansas Methodist. And he says, "True humility is intelligent self-respect, which keeps us from thinking too highly or too meanly of ourselves. It makes us modest by reminding us how far we have come short of what we can be." Isn't that us? I think so. I think he nailed it. Also, incidentally, I'm getting messages from country music these days too, believe it or not. Earlier this week, I sat and I was making notes for today about what I was going to say today, and thoughts were not coming to me very readily. It was in the morning. I had Good Morning America on, but I wasn't really listening to it. It was just on, you know how that is. But I suddenly, as I sat there with an empty piece of paper and a pen in my hand, I became aware that Gretchen Wilson was being interviewed and then singing, and she was singing a song from her latest album, and the song is Heaven Help Me Because I Can't Help Myself. And I thought, right on, Gretchen. Turn it over, and the words will come. And I started making notes in a hurry. And another one that I enjoy hearing, I've got it on record, and I play it every once in a while. It was written by Jerry Reed, who's one of my favorites anyway. He's a great picker and a funny guy. Writes funny, wonderful, humorous songs. But he wrote a song called Today Is Mine that has lines in it like, today is mine, my own special cup to fill, today is mine. To die a little that I might learn to live, to take from life that I might learn to give, today is mine. I think Jerry may be a one of us, having written a song like that. I'm not sure, but I think he might be. At the end of a chapter in an online encyclopedia on a chapter on humility appears, Mark, you'll be interested in this, the prayer found in the pocket of an unknown Confederate soldier. I have carried a copy of this in my pocket for many years. I quoted it in the tape that Mark heard, and he's carried a copy of it in his pocket for sometime, I'm sure. It said, I asked God for strength that I might achieve. I was made weak that I might learn humbly to obey. I asked for health that I might do greater things. I was given infirmity that I might do better things. I asked for riches that I might be happy. I was given poverty that I might be wise. I asked for power that I might have the praise of men. And I was given weakness that I might feel the need of God. I asked for all things that I might enjoy life. And I was given life that I might enjoy all things. I got nothing that I asked for, but everything that I had hoped for. Almost despite myself, my unspoken prayers were answered. And I am among all men most richly blessed. I wish all of those same blessings for you, and thank you very much for making me a part of your day today. Yeah.